So it was that on 12th of December, the public decided to go looking for Agatha's corpse. "Great search today by public for Mrs. Christie," wrote the Sunday Pictorial. "Motorists asked by police to join in hunt on Downs. Appeal for bloodhounds." Rather in the way that thousands of people would descend upon Kensington after the death of Diana, Princess of Wales, motivated as much as anything by the desire to be part of an event, from early Sunday morning, the excited crowds came to Newland's Corner. Among them was the crime novelist Dorothy L. Sayers. As advised by Kenwood and his force, the public came dressed in hardy clothes. A police officer said it was no use people turning out in patent leather shoes, and carried sticks. A half-dozen bloodhounds duly made their appearance. Large areas were covered by the search. Horses were used to carry instructions to far-flung groups of people, although inevitably some of the volunteer hunters were more energetic than others, and Alfred Lewland's refreshment kiosk was popular. Rumours of discoveries were rife. The best find was a number of handbags, which the Daily Express strove to present as potentially significant. Estimates varied as to the size of the crowds. The Daily Mail said there were 5,000 people, the Daily Sketch said 10,000, the Express and the Westminster Gazette 15,000. The Times, more judiciously, had the crowd at just 2,000. Although, even so, the roads were blocked with traffic, and parked cars covered the whole of the plateau where the abandoned motor car was found. Around 400 cars had turned up, or 3,000, according to the Sketch. A jolly good time, it would seem, was had by all. It was perhaps unsurprising that Archie, who had not taken part in the great Sunday hunt, should have told the Daily Express, "I am sure she will not return until all is quiet." The back pages of the newspapers were covered with pictures of the search at Newland's Corner. Also reported was the disappearance of 20-year-old Una Crowe, who had walked out of her family home in Chelsea on the morning of Saturday the 11th. "Daughter of a famous diplomat missing," ran the headline in the Express. Another mystery of a missing woman has been added to that of Mrs. Agatha Christie. On the 13th of December, the newspapers reached the height of their madness. Was Agatha dead? Was she alive? Was she in Hindhead, as suggested by the manager of the Royal Huts Hotel, which had entertained her to lunch at the weekend? Was she in London disguised as a man? This was reported with all apparent seriousness as the latest police theory. The Daily News revealed that Archie had made a prolonged investigation to check if any of his clothes were missing. The Westminster Gazette referred back to the letter left for Charlotte Fisher. "Sealed note in Christie case to be opened, only if body is found." Then quoted from Mrs. Hemsley, Agatha's mother-in-law, who had suggested that the half-written novel, The Blue Train, might contain the solution to the real-life mystery. The paper also made mention of a white-clad figure which had been seen haunting Newland's Corner, an area that became deadlier by the day. The Daily Sketch informed readers that seances have been held in the open air on the Downs and in incense-laden rooms in Guildford and adjacent towns. A journalist attended one, held by a well-known medium, whose spirit guide, Maisie, an African girl, tribe unknown, told him that Agatha had been waylaid by two men in Bayswater. The journalist was a skeptic. Nevertheless, he got his story, and incidentally showed the extraordinary lunacies that Agatha was leading people to commit. The 14th brought reports of a hut at East Clandon, barely a couple of miles from Newland's Corner, that bore signs of habitation. The reliably sensationalist Westminster Gazette described it as a kind of eerie Hansel and Gretel house in the loneliest part of the Surrey Hills. It contained a postcard, the end of a loaf, and a fur coat. Also an empty bottle labelled poison, lead and opium. The police, it was said, had strewn powder on the floor of the hut so that they would know if anybody entered it. This morning there were clear traces of a woman's footprint over the powder. All, however, was not as it seemed. A rogue reporter had scattered the powder, then asked the barmaid of a Guildford hotel to put her foot in it. The opium was a medicine for the treatment of diarrhea. The few belongings that had been left in the hut, a perfectly normal, if remote, cottage, were the possessions of its owners. Meanwhile, Kenwood was off again, telling the Daily Mail of his plans for another huge search around Newland's Corner. All ravines, streams, and ponds in the area will be combed. He reiterated that a body would be found and sought to regain the backing of the reporters, by now slightly bored with his unproductive theory in his quest. The newspapers are suggesting that Mrs. Christie is alive. If this is so, why has she not written to her bankers, her agents, or her solicitors, or to any of her relatives, without divulging her address? She has not written any such letter for a reason which is obvious, that she is dead. Unfortunately for Kenwood's subsequent reputation, Agatha had written just such a letter, to Campbell Christie, and he had chosen to ignore it. Yet even as Kenwood was speaking to the Mail, the mystery was being quietly solved. On Sunday the 12th, two members of the band of the Harrogate Hydro, Bob Tappin and Bob Leeming, had gone to the local police station to report their suspicions about the quiet, smiling Mrs. Neal, who so resembled the photographs of the missing Mrs. Christie. The next day, officers of the West Riding Police went to the hotel, and after observing the woman, were of the opinion that Agatha had been found. They contacted Kenwood, who took no notice and continued with his plans to search the area around Newland's Corner. First thing on Tuesday, the Yorkshire police were again in touch with Kenwood, emphasizing to him that whatever his own doubts, Agatha's household should nonetheless be informed. Accordingly, he telephoned Charlotte Fisher at Stiles and asked her to travel to Harrogate in order to establish if this was indeed her employer. She then contacted Archie, who took the train north. According to the Daily Express, Kenwood was still expressing skepticism barely an hour before Agatha was identified. "I do not think there is anything in the Harrogate end," he said. Later, he claimed that Archie, too, had had doubts about the sighting. Tappin and Leeming were not the only people in the hotel, or indeed in the Harry Cobb band, to have recognized Agatha. Rosie Asher, who had acted as her chambermaid throughout her stay, had done so early on. Much later, she said that she had not dared to go to the police. "I suppose I was one of the first to know, but it was more than my job was worth to get involved." She had found Mrs. Neal a bit odd from the start, with her one small case and her withdrawn, ghostly air. Among her few possessions were the unusual buckled shoes reproduced in a newspaper photograph of Agatha, and the zipped handbag described by the police. Then it dawned on me. Mrs. Taylor, manageress of the Hydro, also had her doubts, which she mentioned only to her husband. "I took on a certain responsibility in not informing the police," she told the Mail. "Someone outside the hotel informed the police, although some of the servants here had said that there seemed to be a great resemblance between the woman and the pictures. I told them to say nothing." Certain of the guests had also wondered, but the suspicions never led to action. The people at the Hydro were not that kind, nor were the people of Harrogate. "Of course we knew it was her, but we didn't say anything," a town resident said many years later. If Mrs. Christie wanted to be there on her own, wandering around and buying clothes, that was entirely her business. Harrogate would not worry, so long as she fitted in. It was aristocratic, discreet, impregnable. An incongruous place for this particular journey to have ended, and yet for Agatha, the obvious one. Harrogate was the Torquay of the North. It was where people like us went, even when they disappeared. And it could not have been more removed from the world of obsessive policemen and news-hungry journalists, who, for all their frenetic pursuit, had failed to find Agatha, who had ignored the one clue given by the woman herself that could have taken them to her. Small wonder the press found it so hard to forgive her when she was finally discovered in the place where she had said she was going. It was not her fault that she had made a fool of so many people. She had not asked them to search the undergrowth of the North Downs, or to drain pools, or to espy her on London buses. She had not wanted to become the headline story in almost every newspaper for the past week. She had become public property, despite herself, and now there was not a single thing she could do about it. The press felt that she had led them a dance. This was true, although again she had not asked them to be led. So too with those members of the public who had speculated endlessly about Mrs. Christie's fate. She had aroused their pity on false pretenses, had made them think that she was a hapless corpse, when in fact she was a sleek and well-fed resident at a swell hotel. All right for some. Had caused them to behave in ways they would not otherwise have done. She had made them look silly. Now she would suffer for it. On the evening of Monday the 13th, the reporters were tipped off that their quarry might be found. Some travelled up to Harrogate immediately and spent Tuesday trying to identify the hotel at which Agatha was said to be staying. The Evening Standard took the plunge and, in its 14th of December afternoon edition, stated that a woman was awaiting identification by Colonel Christie. Archie arrived in Harrogate just after 6:30, and with Superintendent McDowell of the West Riding Police, went to the Hydro, where he met the manageress, Mrs. Taylor. Mrs. Neal was upstairs, dressing for dinner. Her handwriting in the register was Agatha's, slightly disguised. At around 7:30, Agatha came down the stairs and saw Archie, who confirmed with McDowell that this was indeed his wife. Outside, the press waited. Soon they would be let loose upon Colonel Christie, no longer a wife murderer, now participating in a whole new cover-up. The newspapers of the 15th of December splashed the discovery. Amid the Christmas advertisements for Derry and Toms, Whiteley's, Bourne and Hollingsworth, the headlines blazed, "Mrs. Christie found at Harrogate." And then Archie's desperate lie, given to the press the night before, "She does not know who she is." Details were given of Agatha's stay at the Hydro. Inevitably, there were discrepancies, as each newspaper found its own source for information. The Daily Mail went to the top of the tree and spoke to Mr. Taylor, manager of the hotel, whose wife had suspected that the missing woman was in their midst. "Mrs. Christie arrived at the Harrogate Hydropathic on the Saturday in a taxicab," he said. "From the first, her life in the Hydro was exactly similar to that of our other guests. She took her meals in the public dining room, only occasionally having her breakfast in bed. In the evening, we sometimes have singing and dancing in the lounge. In this, Mrs. Christie took an enthusiastic part. She sang several songs. What they were I do not remember, for I am not musical, and she danced often, mixing freely with the young people staying in the Hydro. What account of herself she gave to them I cannot tell you, but although I understand they remarked several times to each other on the resemblance between their fellow guest and the missing woman, they did not really believe she could be Mrs. Christie." The Mail also said that she bought a good many clothes while staying in Harrogate. At the Hydro, she spoke little at first, then made some friends. Another guest, Mrs. Robson, was given to understand that her child had died and she was recovering. She played billiards occasionally, although rarely made more than 5 or 6 at a time. The Westminster Gazette, however, spoke to an employee at the hotel, who had seen Agatha play, and, although she had told her opponent, a foreign gentleman staying at the hotel, that she could not play, some of us, who were watching at the game, remarked that she must have been kidding him. "She is a fine, good-looking woman," he said, and was looking cheerful, often joking with the members of staff. She did not hide herself at all from the public gaze, but on the contrary took quite an active part in the life of the hotel, being very fond of singing and playing in the lounge. There was certainly nothing to suggest that she was in ill health. The Daily Express spoke to the hotel's lady entertainer, Miss Corbett, who was full of after-the-event wisdom. "We've all been saying it was Mrs. Christie, but we hardly like to do anything. She has done a great deal of singing to my accompaniment. She has a very high soprano voice and she sings very nicely. One of the hotel guests, a shipping merchant named Mr. Pettleston, described to the Express how he had seen Mrs. Neal the previous evening before dinner, and she had said to him, "Oh, fancy, my brother has come." Mr. Pettleston said that other guests at the Hydro had thought she was Mrs. Christie, although he had never dreamed it. She seemed, he said, to be always thinking. I said to her once, "Where do you come from? Do you live in London?" She replied, "No, I do not live in London. I live in South Africa." I did not like to pursue the matter further, as she did not seem to want to encourage the conversation. The next day, Mr. Pettleston talked some more, telling the Daily News that he and Agatha had become great friends. Perhaps it was because we were both interested in music. He described how she had bought and signed for him a copy of the sheet music to "Angels Ever Guard Thee," which they had played together. He also elaborated upon the meeting with Archie. It seemed at the time strange to me for a brother to be as despondent as he was. The next day, in fact, a good many things had started to seem strange. On the 15th, the newspapers had dutifully parroted the amnesia theory, describing the pathetic little scene of reunion between the Christies and Archie's attempts to get Agatha to recognize him. They had done this with a fair degree of sympathy and compassion. Now cynicism began to stream back into the reporters' hearts. "No evidence of lost memory," scoffed the headline in the Westminster Gazette, which had consulted leading mental specialists on the subject. It was not possible to lose one's memory and continue to act in such a normal manner, showing no signs of distress, nor was it feasible that Agatha would have failed to recognize her own name in the newspapers. Archie clung to his theory, however, and told reporters that although Agatha knew nothing of how she had arrived at Harrogate, she was beginning to regain her memory. "This morning," he said, "she has a faint idea that she is Mrs. Christie." The reporters had been struck by Agatha's demeanour as she took the train from Harrogate to Leeds, thence to Manchester. She chatted gaily with her sister and once laughingly patted her on the shoulder. This looked a little like mockery, and the newspapers began to get vicious. They knew that their readers felt similarly aggrieved, so they were on safe ground, especially when they brought up the issue of money. How much had the search for Agatha cost? The Daily Sketch gave estimates of between £1,000 and £3,000, although the figure would go up dramatically, eventually reaching the ludicrous heights of £25,000. The Daily Mail started a correspondence on the subject of the remarkable and, it seems to some of us, unjustifiable concentration of the police of two counties on the disappearance of Mrs. Christie, wrote one reader. "I see no reason why the police should have expended thousands of pounds which could not be collected from anyone connected with the missing novelist." Then there was the question of the name Agatha had assumed in Harrogate. A name which coincides with that of the young woman who, in addition to Colonel Christie, visited Hurtmore Cottage, the Godalming home of Mr. and Mrs. James, as the Westminster Gazette somewhat pointedly put it. The Daily Express was also alert, writing that Archie had requested particularly that this name his wife had used at the Hydro should not be divulged. It then informed readers that Archie had no intention of contributing to the cost of the search. "I did not ask them to search for her," he said. "I knew all the time that she was alive, and I told them so." This, of course, was unanswerable. But logic no longer had much to do with the way that this case was reported. The public story of the disappearance had been created in the minds of thousands of people. Yet it was Agatha herself who had written it, and it was not the story that people wanted. The subtleties of what she had done were beyond the public grasp. It was therefore decided that her mysterious creation was nothing more or less than a set-up. She had eluded everybody for 11 days. Now she eluded them again, locked as she was behind the gates of Abney Hall, and frustration poured out. "Millions of fine fellows were killed in the war, and practically no notice was taken of them," said Mr. Mitchell Hedges, the well-known explorer, to the Sketch. yet paralysis set in when one woman disappeared. If loss of memory could be proved, wrote the Express, then sympathy for Agatha would flow. Meanwhile, the joke was on the police who argued that she was lying dead near Newland's Corner, the willing crowds who tramped the downs in search, the good people who saw her at various irreconcilable times and places. The Surrey Advertiser, which took a proprietorial interest in the case, summed up the general mood. Mrs. Christie has been found, but the mystery surrounding her disappearance is very far from being cleared up. Indeed, to many people, the whole business gets mysteriouser and mysteriouser, with successive explanations. We all rejoice that Mrs. Christie is alive and well, or was well, to all appearances, until the arrival of her husband at the Harrogate Hydro on Tuesday evening. But frankly, the public are puzzled and bewildered. When did memory loss kick in? When she left her car at Newland's Corner? If so, it is passing strange that one so afflicted should have been able to find her way to London, cross the city from one terminus to another, book to Harrogate. Medical men may be familiar with such cases. The layman, in his ignorance, simply wonders. Another puzzle, almost but not quite as great, is how Mrs. Christie came to remain unidentified for so long. Just think of it. For 10 days, she was the most talked-about person in the country. All the while, the cause of this sensation is pursuing the normal life of a normal person at a hotel where there were numbers of guests, talking to them, even singing to them, yet unidentified. We withdraw the qualification in the first sentence in this note. The one puzzle is as great as the other, if not greater. On the 17th of December, the last day that the case was headline news, Archie faced the reporters outside Abney Hall and handed to them a medical bulletin. It was signed by Dr. Donald Corr, lecturer in neurology from Manchester University, and the Watts' family doctor, Henry Wilson, and it read, "After a careful examination of Mrs. Agatha Christie this afternoon, we have formed the opinion that she is suffering from an unquestionably genuine loss of memory, and that for her future welfare she should be spared all anxiety and excitement." Archie added his own statement, reported in the Times. "My wife is extremely ill, suffering from complete loss of memory. 3 years have dropped out of her life. She cannot recall anything that has happened during that period. She has not the slightest recollection of going to Newland's Corner or of proceeding eventually to Harrogate. She now knows who I am, and has also realized that Mrs. Watts is her sister. It is somewhat remarkable that she does not know she has a daughter. In this connection, when she was shown a picture of herself and Rosalind, her little daughter, she asked who the child was, what is the child like, and how old is she?" In conclusion, Archie made a plea for privacy. "All the worry has been terrible, and all we want now is peace and quietness. I have been offered £500 to tell how my wife came to Harrogate. I do not know, and she cannot tell me. And I hope," he said to the Daily Sketch, "that ends the matter." But if nothing else, Archie's own inability to evade questioning would ensure yet more coverage. The Sketch asked him about the suggestion that Agatha's disappearance had been a publicity stunt, all arranged to sell her books, which he fiercely denied. "It has been nothing of the sort. The doctor's report proves it." The reporters also asked about the even more dangerous subject of Agatha's use of the name Neil, that of a mutual friend, as Archie had told the Daily Mail. She inserted the advertisement in the Times under the name of Neil, asking her relatives to communicate, because she was in the extraordinary position of being in a strange hotel for no purpose that she could think of, and with no knowledge of who she was, other than the conviction that Teresa Neil was her real name. "The doctors told me that such an action was compatible with the action of a person suffering from loss of memory." The Mail then proceeded to print a few paragraphs about our mutual friend, Miss Neil, whose father had given a brief interview from his home in Hertfordshire. "I cannot hazard any theory why Mrs. Christie should have used my family name. It is unfortunate," he said, "that Nancy should have been a member of the house party of Mr. and Mrs. James during the weekend that Mrs. Christie disappeared, and that Colonel Christie should also have been a member of that party. To the Westminster Gazette, Mr. Neal said a little more. "It is most unpleasant, both for my daughter and for all of us in the family, to have her name dragged through the mud, and furthermore, it is quite unnecessary." Mrs. Neal told the reporter that Nancy was a friend of the Christies, but she has never been especially friendly with the Colonel. Her daughter, she said, was very distressed over the whole affair. The Gazette also alighted upon the incident of the ring that Agatha had left for repair at Harrods on Saturday the 4th, giving to the store the address of the Harrogate Hydro, to which the ring was sent. It is accordingly established beyond doubt that Mrs. Neal, en route for Harrogate, was in the West End on the Saturday morning of Mrs. Agatha Christie's disappearance, making purchases like any normal woman. However much Archie insisted that Agatha was extremely ill and that it would take weeks for her to recover, his statements were received with almost complete disbelief. As Lady Pontifex wrote in the Daily Mail, "Many of us would also like to know how the statement that she has lost her memory squares with the fact that she has stayed in an hotel, paid her bills, danced and sung, and played billiards." The money question also continued to rankle. Archie had stated that the additional expenses incurred by the search were no more than £25, and that, as a ratepayer, he was under no obligation to meet them. A Surreyite wrote to his local newspaper, The Advertiser, that "the best thing Colonel Christie can do to show his gratitude for the restoration of his wife is to pay all the expenses connected with that search. It is sad enough to know that one of our Surrey beauty spots has had to suffer by being trampled down and disfigured unnecessarily. Perhaps when Mrs. Christie's memory returns, she will make what reparation she can by seeing that the ratepayers do not suffer for her disappearance." Agatha, and to a lesser extent Archie, had become a focus for public opprobrium. She was regarded as a devious woman whose husband was defending her in inappropriate and possibly self-serving ways. She was attacked in a manner characteristic of the British public. Enviously, resentfully, pruriently, and with a strong dash of "who does she think she is?" A letter was sent to the Mail from an ordinary woman, saying that she would like to know what would happen if she disappeared. Would she get the same preferential treatment as Agatha had received? When the body of poor Una Crowe was found on the 21st, suicide after a nervous breakdown, it was quite obvious what people were thinking. Here was somebody who had really done what Agatha had pretended to do. Here was a good person, truly deserving of sympathy, not a jumped-up attention seeker. Newspaper coverage sensed the mood and did not hesitate to inflame it. Probably the reporters shared it. Female hate figures are a common feature in the press today. It is almost as though society needs them as a repository for its less elevated emotions. "The world is not charitable in what it says about women," Agatha would later write. She was subjected to something scarcely less cruel than a modern tabloid witch hunt, for having committed the crime of allowing her private anguish to move into the public arena. In February 1927, questions were asked in the House of Commons about the cost of the search. Sir William Joynson Hicks, the Home Secretary, answered that the total additional cost to the Surrey Police was about £12.10, but other MPs were not going to let this go so easily. "Who," it was asked, "is going to compensate the thousands of people who were deliberately misled by this cruel hoax?" Joynton Hicks' reply, which was that people had simply joined the search out of curiosity, was, of course, the truth. But nobody wanted to hear it. As always with populist stupidity, there was absolutely nothing whatever to be done about it. The theory that Agatha had known exactly what she was doing all along, that she had disappeared voluntarily and led both police and public a deliberate dance, remains attractive to many. People still emerge from time to time with tales of how they once met someone who was staying at Harrogate when she was there, and oh yes, she was definitely up to something. The sceptical view appeals in part for the same reason as it did back in 1926. It is a reaction against the amnesia theory, that was initially propounded by Archie and upheld for years by the family. So unlikely is it that Agatha lost her memory, so unconvinced is almost everybody that she did, that the official insistence upon this explanation tends to irritate. It makes people think that something is being hidden, something detrimental, and it sends theorists in precisely the opposite direction. Those who do not believe that Agatha lost her wits when she disappeared tend to think instead that she was in full possession of them, planning a plot, as she did with her stories. But this was not that kind of story. Despite what he said to reporters after the event, Archie himself believed that Agatha had known what she was doing. A letter sent to Rosalind many years later said that, according to his friend Madge James, he had felt that the disappearance was a publicity stunt. So too did Madge and her husband, and so, presumably, did Nancy Neal. The phrase publicity stunt implies that Agatha had disappeared to advance her career as a mystery writer. But this was not what Archie meant. Rather, that she had tried to create publicity against him. She had tried to generate a furor of sympathy that would lead him to be discredited and jeopardize his relationship with Nancy. It was inevitable, perhaps, that Archie saw things this way. Undoubtedly, he would have felt guilt about Agatha, and guilt always hardened his heart. Also, he had been through hell, and blaming Agatha was the easiest way of dealing with it. Possibly, deep down, he did not entirely believe his own words to Madge James. Possibly he was using the simplistic explanation of the stunt as a shield for deeper feelings, which it was his instinct to hide. The theory of deliberate intent was laid out in a famous piece of journalism in The New Statesman, written just after Agatha's death by Richie Calder. He described the way the story had taken possession of the newspapers, even the sedate Times, and the hints from the police that this was a murder case. In those days, crime reporters and police were very much in cahoots. He aired various rumours from the time as if they were fact, including the idea that Archie and Nancy had been attending an unofficial engagement dinner on the night that Agatha disappeared. He also wrote about Agatha's demeanour on the night she was discovered at the Harrogate Hydro. She was not flustered. She answered to Mrs. Christie, and when asked how she had got there, she said that she did not know and was suffering from amnesia. There is no evidence at all that Agatha spoke to the press on the 14th of December. The newspapers would certainly have reported it if she had. And this throws doubt upon Calder's piece. He was quite right, though, in his conclusion. Emotionally disturbed, yes. Suffering from amnesia, no. Closer to the truth, in a way, was the 1979 film Agatha, which caught something of her dreamlike state as she drifted ghost-like through Harrogate. The actual plot is absurd. Agatha concocts a means to kill herself by Nancy Neal's hand, and although the film is extremely sympathetic to her mother, it is understandable that Rosalind sought to stop it being made. Yet it grasped the essential truths that Agatha might have been planning without being in control of her thoughts, and that throughout the 11 days she was writing her own story. Far more brutal to Agatha was Jared Cade's 1996 book, Agatha Christie and the 11 Missing Days, which purported to solve once and for all the mystery of the disappearance. It was based upon a version of events told to the author by the daughter of Agatha's friend, Nan Conn. As has been emphasized, Nan's daughter Judith was 10 years old at the time of the disappearance. Therefore, her account came entirely from her mother, who must have told her everything in remarkable detail. For some reason, she waited a very long time to allow this story to be told, despite its apparent newsworthiness. According to Judith, Agatha planned to disappear to Harrogate in order to punish Archie for his affair with Nancy, and she did so with Nan's help. On the morning of Friday the 3rd, she drove to London to visit Nan and discuss the plan, before returning to Stiles for lunch. She left Styles at 9:45 on the evening of 3rd of December, drove straight to Newlands Corner, pushed the car down the slope, then walked to West Clandon Station in Surrey, and caught a train to London. She stayed the night with Nan at her house in Chelsea. In the morning, the women rang hotels in Harrogate, asking about vacancies, but being told that none was full, they decided that Agatha should turn up unannounced at the Hydro. This would give credibility to the amnesia theory. Nan gave Agatha some money, went shopping with her at the Army and Navy stores for clothes and a case, then lunched with her and put her on the train to Harrogate. This theory is at first quite compelling. Some things about it are perceptive and accurate. For example, the importance it gives to the letter that Agatha wrote to Campbell Christie. But there is a flaw in the theory that renders it impossible. The distance between Styles at Sunningdale and Newlands Corner is not great, just under 20 miles. To drive it nowadays would take between 30 and 40 minutes. Obviously, in 1926, cars were slower and less agile, and Agatha was driving on a dark winter's night. Nevertheless, it is possible, for the sake of argument, to assume that she drove at full speed to Newlands Corner and arrived at 10:30. She then had to manoeuvre the car onto the plateau at the top of the hill, and again in pitch darkness, give it an almighty shove that would send it down the slopes. Steep though these are, they are not vertiginous, and to push the Morris would not have been an especially easy job. Nevertheless, it can be assumed, again, that this went without a hitch and took no more than 5 minutes. Agatha then had to walk along the unlit, unfamiliar roads to reach the station at West Clandon, approximately 2.25 miles away. Assuming that she went at the brisk pace of 4 miles an hour, assuming even that she broke into an occasional run, this journey would still take more than 30 minutes. So Agatha would have arrived at the station a little after 11 o'clock. This, at the very earliest, assuming a quick and straightforward journey along dark and bending roads, an untroubled shove of the car down the hill, and a sprightly walk, in high heels, through the night. And here lies the central flaw in the Jared Cade theory. According to the Bradshaw Railway Guide for December 1926, the last London train from Clandon left at 10:52 p.m. There are other problems too. Even if one accepts the theory, why on earth would Agatha have made things so difficult for herself? If this was part of a plan, why leave so little time to accomplish all that she had to do? Why not leave at 9 o'clock instead? And although there is logic to the idea that she wanted to abandon her Morris near Godalming, thus implicating Archie and drawing attention to his whereabouts, it is barely conceivable that Agatha would have chosen the arduous task of shoving the car down a hill when there were so many other tempting places in that area to suggest misadventure. Why not leave it by the silent pool? If she did push the car, she would have no idea where it would end up. There was no guarantee whatever that it would become stuck in so peculiarly sinister a position, overhanging a quarry. In fact, the shape of the landscape makes it almost impossible that it would have done so, since it followed the track of Water Lane, then took an unnatural right-hand swerve. There was also the question of how it travelled downhill for 300 yards, constantly gathering speed before it hit the bush above the quarry, and yet suffered so little damage that it could be driven away to the garage. Added to the extreme unlikelihood of Agatha deciding that this was the best way to deal with her car, there is then the amazing fact that, amid all the many sightings, nobody should have remembered the lone female answering the police description who took the last train from Clandon to Waterloo, and that no taxi driver should have remembered picking her up at around 1:45. There is something more, though. And this is the fact that renders all talk of deliberate intent quite meaningless. Newlands Corner, on a December night, is a fearful place. To stand there alone, in the silence, under the black winter skies, and look out over the vast empty slopes, is a terrifying thing to do. No woman, especially a woman of imagination, could do such a thing out of malice, or revenge, or any such petty motive. The place annihilates such a possibility. Those who have not been to Newland's Corner in the dark may accept the idea that Agatha could have got out of the car, pushed it away, and skipped off to the railway station. To go there is to know instinctively that this is not possible, that nobody could endure that place without the mysterious insulation of mental agony. On a more pragmatic level, in his book, Cade extracts the facts he requires from accounts of the disappearance and dismisses those that do not fit. For example, he takes Janet Morgan's authorized biography to task, while making much use of it, for a minor mistake about train times to Harrogate, but completely ignores the fact that his theory puts Agatha on a train from Clandon that she could not possibly have caught. He also disregards the sighting of Agatha at around 6:20 a.m. on Saturday the 4th by the local man, Edward McAllister, who said he started her car. Admittedly, this is not corroborated evidence and is complicated by the newspaper references to Ernest Cross. But McAllister came forward very early, before publicity had muddled the investigative waters, and his description of Agatha to the Surrey Advertiser is convincing. The police, not just Kenwood, also took the story seriously, and it seems far more likely than not to be true, unless, as the Advertiser wrote, by a coincidence so improbable as hardly to be worth entertaining, another woman closely resembling her was the person the man McAllister saw. That was the fact of it. Not many women drove through the early mornings, alone, back in 1926. Cade also uses what was reported in newspapers, representing it as corroborated evidence, when he suits his purposes. He repeats the words of Agatha's Sunningdale friend, Mrs. De Silva, without benefit of quotation marks, so that her self-important witterings to reporters become unarguable fact. Yet when Mrs. De Silva told a newspaper that she had telephoned Agatha around midday on Friday the 3rd, asking her to tea, he ignores it, as it would clash with his theory that Agatha was not at home at that time, having driven to London in order to meet Nan Conn. This is a small example of the book's fundamental naughtiness. Throughout, the author describes scenes that he cannot possibly know about, such as the conversation between Agatha and Archie on the morning of the disappearance, as if he himself had been present. The omniscience of his interviewee, Judith, or more precisely of her mother, is boundless. There is nothing about Agatha that they did not know. Nan, to be sure, was a good friend. Judith, too, was close to both Agatha and Rosalind, until some strange impulse led her to collaborate on a book that could only cause Rosalind great pain. But they were not the repositories for Agatha's secrets. This role was filled most closely by Charlotte Fisher. It has therefore been suggested that Charlotte was Agatha's accomplice in the disappearance. The advertisement placed in the Times was part of a code between the two women, and the letter Agatha left told Charlotte what she intended to do. However, as the letter was in the possession of the police throughout the inquiry, this cannot be so. The advertisement placed in the Times does look like a message, and if so, for whom but Charlotte? But Charlotte was simply not the kind of woman to practice such a level of deceit. If she had known anything, she would have said so. What is true is that she learned a good deal after the event, and this she told subsequently to Rosalind. It is understandable, laudable indeed, that Rosalind should have clung for so long and so obstinately to the official theory. Her mother had driven off into the night and left her. Her father was willing to leave her for good, but her loyalty to both was absolute. She wanted to protect them, so she adhered to the line that they had taken from the very first. Agatha had become ill during 1926, and at some point during the traumatic night of the 3rd to 4th of December, had lost her memory. It was said that Agatha did not recognize her daughter when she saw her again at Abney. This is impossible to believe, although it is very easy to imagine Agatha pretending to do such a thing. Like her character Jane Finn in The Secret Adversary, she may have feigned memory loss as as a means of protecting herself. She would have felt the deepest shame about what she had done, and never more so than in the presence of her daughter. Amnesia was a way out of the responsibility. But the official theory has never held water, and it could never be proclaimed indefinitely. It ignores too many facts, not least about the way in which amnesia works. Certainly, it is a mysterious affliction, but it does not take possession of a person for a couple of weeks and then go away again, never to return. To explain Agatha's movements between the 3rd and 4th of December, which have a degree of design about them, it is said that she drove around for much of the night, so distraught that she did not know where she was going. Yet 2 gallons of petrol were left in her car, so she cannot have driven very far. Then it is said that she careered off the road at Newlands Corner and ran into the bush overhanging the quarry, perhaps concussing herself as she stopped. This, too, is unlikely, since she would surely have tried to apply the brakes during a descent, and there were no signs that she had done so. Although it was entirely possible for a car to come off the road, it was almost impossible for it to end up 300 yards down the hill, unless intent of some kind was involved. Despite being in a state of extreme physical distress, Agatha is then said to have made her way to Guildford Station, almost 4 miles away, which meant climbing the steep hill to get to the main road. She took a train to Waterloo, thence to King's Cross, thence to Harrogate. Posters for Harrogate were prominent in railway stations at that time. The suggestion is that this put the idea into Agatha's head. Once she had arrived, the idea of going to the Hydro also occurred to her, perhaps because there were at that time cars at the station taking guests to the various hotels, although Agatha was actually reported to have arrived at the Hydro in a taxi. According to the official theory, she did not take part in the activities of the hotel. Dancing and singing were off the agenda for a woman in Agatha's condition. Yet the evidence that suggests she did these things is considerable. Of course, some of the reporting of her behaviour at the hotel is highly dubious, and the words of some of the guests were doubtless exaggerated or misinterpreted. But the fact is that the sheet music to Angels Ever Guard Thee, signed Teresa Neal, was indeed in the possession of Alexander Pettleson. His daughter offered it to Agatha's publishers in the 1970s. Collins turned it down on Agatha's behalf, saying that she was ill and no doubt thinking it would upset her. The advertisement that was placed in the Times, which the conspiracy theorists regard as Agatha seeking to validate her claim to have lost her memory, is inconvenient to the amnesia theory. So too is the ring Agatha left at Harrods, which was subsequently posted to Mrs. Neal. And why should Agatha have abandoned her car so near to Godalming if she had not been thinking directly of Archie? There are many questions that the official theory simply fails to answer. Yet it was created for reasons that are far more ignoble, not, as has often been suggested, to conceal, but to protect a fragile woman who had suffered immeasurably in ways too complex for any theory to encompass. And it comes infinitely closer to the truth than any talk of stunts or schemes ever could. It understands that Agatha had been in a state of breakdown, that the cumulative effect of her mother's death and her husband's betrayal had sent her to the edge, but not over it. The aftermath was somber, a sad and drawn-out hangover, in which several reputations were subjected to an unforgiving scrutiny. Nancy Neal was sent on a round-the-world trip by her parents, in the hope that she would live down the press attention and get over Archie. He himself had to face his colleagues in the city, in those days a gentlemanly world that did not deal in open scandal. Company directors did not come close to being accused of murder, and closer still to adultery. Neither did they have hysterical wives, who became front-page news. Archie left Agatha at Abney Hall on the 17th of December, before returning with Rosalind for Christmas. Afterwards, he went back to Stiles and began the process of selling the house. The Jameses were left to contemplate the part they had played in allowing Archie and Nancy to meet at their house. Madge James, said to have been a silly woman, had assumed Archie's marriage to be over in all but name, but she should not have put the interests of her friend Nancy above those of the inconvenient wife. It must have been a shock to realize that Agatha did not share Archie's view of their marriage. Sam James, who was not silly at all, may have understood Agatha's grounds for distress, but he was a loyal friend and took Archie's side throughout. The two couples came to the tacit conclusion that the only way to deal with the whole affair was to dismiss Agatha as a hysteric and get on with life. They were all holidaying together in the south of France just before the outbreak of the Second World War, when Sam died of sunstroke. For a time after this, Archie and Nancy lodged in the grounds of Madge's huge house at Godalming. The friends always remained close. They had been through a lot together. After Agatha was found, it was said, rather debatedly, by the Westminster Gazette, that perhaps the chief sufferer has been Mr. Kenwood, a responsible and reliable officer. In 1927, Kenwood was obliged to make a report to the Home Office, explaining his much-criticised handling of the case. "I submit," he wrote, in a tone of muted defiance, "that the circumstances fully justified me in taking the action that I did." He denied the claims about large numbers of police being diverted from other duties. Only 36 regular police were employed in the search, he said. There were also innumerable special constables, who were unpaid, and a great many civilian helpers. Inquiries in other parts of the country were made by Berkshire police. No other forces were used, and contrary to rumour, Scotland Yard was never called in. The expenses amounted to about £25, made up chiefly of hire of conveniences and refreshments for the special constables, a sum which Colonel Christie had been asked and refused to pay. This sum is double the one quoted in the House of Commons, but it still seems very low, as does the number of officers involved in the case. Kenwood's chief defence for having stuck to the belief that Agatha was dead was the disquieting nature of certain information that had come to my knowledge. Many years later, Kenwood's daughter would state that this referred to a fourth letter written by Agatha, in which she said that she was in fear for her life. This assertion has been roundly discredited. In fact, the letter that had influenced Kenwood was the one written to Charlotte, which was hysterical, suicidal, and accusatory towards Archie. It is not surprising that it loomed large in Kenwood's mind, and he was quite right to say that, had he taken insufficient notice of its contents, he would have been vilified. But in a long interview with the Surrey Advertiser, he went further still. He had, he said, believed that this was a murder case because it was suggested very freely by people who knew her, including some of her own relations, that perhaps something of this nature had occurred. Now this remarkable statement may well have been the words of a man trying to justify himself, knowing full well that he could say rather more outlandishly things to a newspaper than he could to the Home Office. Nevertheless, it gives pause for thought about the role of Madge, Agatha's sister, in all of this. It was unlike her to keep quiet, yet she seems to have done nothing until she gave Agatha sanctuary at Abney Hall. Surely, though, she would have had ideas of her own about what had happened. It is impossible to imagine her telling Kenwood that she suspected Archie of murder. For all her confident eccentricity, she was as reticent as Agatha in the public sphere. But she must have realized that Agatha had disappeared, possibly killed herself, because of Archie's behavior. In other words, that this was all his fault, and she would have been staunchly on Agatha's side. She might therefore have said something to Kenwood that helped lead him towards his wrong-headed theory. In the end, though, there can be little excuse for the fact that Kenwood ignored the clues that did not fit his own ideas, notably the letter to Campbell Christie. He was guilty of forcing facts to fit a theory. He had been a good officer, but this particular case had done for him. 5 years later, He retired from the force and died, aged 56, in 1932. As late as February 1928, Agatha's disappearance was still in the news, her behavior having become a byword for duplicitous conduct. During a libel action, issued coincidentally by the same Mr. Mitchell Hedges who had criticized Agatha back in 1926, reference was made by the prosecuting counsel to a woman who played a foolish hoax on the police. Deeply hurt and provoked by this, Agatha gave an interview to the Daily Mail that purported to give her version of the disappearance. That is to say, the official theory. She also instructed her lawyer to make a statement on her behalf at the libel trial. Accordingly, Mr. Stuart Bevan KC asked the indulgence of the judge to present, in defense of her reputation, the medical certificate that had been issued at Abney Hall. The exchange between lawyer and judge was reported in the Times. The Lord Chief Justice stated that there was not time to spare to hear applications about persons who happened to be referred to in the course of cases. Mr. Bevan replied that, when reference is made to a woman who is not here, is not represented here, and is unable to protect herself, grave injustice is done, unless the full facts are known. To which the judge said, I think that having said so much, Mr. Bevan, you have probably accomplished your purpose. But Agatha had failed to accomplish hers. The actions that had been taken out of love for Archie had, by cruelly uncontrollable means, become the surest way to kill any love he had for her. She had wanted him back. She had dreamed that he would come to Harrogate and be restored to her. And instead, she had ensured that he would want never to lay eyes on her again. The ending of the story had been wrenched from her grasp. When she saw him at the bottom of the stairs at the Harrogate Hydro, hope must have raged in her heart. Yet that night she had gone to bed alone to lie sleepless, facing the wreck of her dreams that she herself had brought about. The next morning she had left the hotel with Archie. She had travelled with him. They had walked side by side. He had defended and protected her against the terrifying assaults of the press. And yet it had meant nothing. He was doing it for himself, for his future life with Nancy Neal. He wanted more than anything not to be with her. Having, as she thought, helped to destroy her marriage by leaving Archie alone while she grieved for her mother, she had now delivered its death blow by making herself an object of public ridicule, and Archie an object of public loathing. They were both private people, intensely so. How had she let this happen? How had it happened? She was back to herself now. The drifting, smiling ghost of Harrogate was gone. She was in the real world. She stayed at Abney and watched the contempt in Archie's eyes, the disdainful exhaustion after he had spoken to the press. And then he left. Those days were the worst of all. You were a king, my love, and I, in the far north, lie nightly down to die. It was an appalling not just distress, but a shock to her, so much so as to mentally unhinge her. There is a woman whom life has treated very well. Very loving mother, handsome and loving husband, and psychologically she could not take this upsetting. I don't think she ever did get over it. I think that the breaking down of any relationship in which a woman has invested so much is one of the universal griefs. And therefore she took pleasure in doing books in which, although there is a complete upsetting of normality, in the end, order is restored. It was a psychological need to bring order out of disorder, which may have mirrored her own life. I think maybe every one of them is a kind of catharsis. All of them, a little catharsis. P.D. James. People still think there's an ulterior motive. Having known her, there's no way she would have done anything like that. John Mallowan, nephew to Agatha. She was in shock. And she was driving her car, and she's got the most inventive mind. She says, "Sort this. I'm going to disappear." Charles Vance, producer of Agatha's plays. It was the unspoken subject. Agatha refused to talk about it. To anyone. It was a real no-go. I was told once in Baghdad that someone had broached the subject, and she wouldn't speak to that person again. Joan Oates, friend of Agatha. I think we all operate on a secret, and if we let that secret out, we'd no longer be able to live. At least, not in the way that we're used to living. Kathleen Tynan, author of Agatha, in an interview with Woman's Wear Daily. I was stupid. I lived in a world of my own. Yes, I was stupid. Agatha, writing as Mary Westmacott in the autobiographical novel Unfinished Portrait. She continued to love him throughout it all, but it shattered the world of fantasy in which her spirit, her genius, lived. This is what led to her breakdown. A.L. Rouse, friend of Agatha, in Memories of Men and Women. Christie was a shit. Charles Vance. You mean detective stories have to end with everything explained? Part of the rules? The unreality. Then if our story disobeys the unreal literary rules, that might mean it's actually truer to life. John Fowles, The Ebony Tower. I know what happened because I was there. Rosalind Hicks, daughter. Although I am now quite well and cheerful, I have not quite that utter happiness of Mrs. Neal. Agatha Christie, in an interview with the Daily Mail, 16th of February 1928.